Hey everybody, it's Paul Yeager, and this is the MTOM Podcast, a production of Iowa PBS and the Market to Market TV show. Cotton is one of those commodities that might only get 20 to 30 seconds in the market analysis segment, but usually it's in Market Plus. But cotton is at the center of an acreage battle when it comes to corn and soybeans as we turn into 2021. Cotton was already on a trajectory up. Will it continue as there may be fewer acres planted in 21? We are going to talk with two men who have dealt with cotton for a number of years and have deep roots in the crop. We will speak with Rogers Varner and also Markham Dossett. Now, Markham is out of Texas and Mr. Varner is out of Mississippi. So the two of them are right in the heart of where cotton is grown and marketed and stored. And we learn a lot about the industry and the battles of 20 and 21 when it comes to acreage and many more factors in this installment of the M2M Podcast. All right, Markham, give me a little background on you. You're in Waco, Texas, so you know, how'd you get there?
My family came to Waco in 1868 after the Civil War. We had been from Mississippi. That's the sleeper side. The Dossett side came in to Texas from Mississippi in 1899. My great-grandfather, A.J. Dossett, was working at the cotton compress in Meridian, Mississippi, and came to Texas to buy the cotton compress in Cameron, Texas, 50 miles south of Waco. Then later, over the next 50 years, and he died in 1921, but then his son and brother-in-laws and cousins, we owned 25 cotton compresses from Quanah, Texas on the Red River all the way to Galveston.
Now, you got to remember, hold on, before I let you tell more of your story, you're going to have to define some things. Compress, is that similar to like a co-op that I would have here in grain country?
No, the way that cotton used to be done and is no longer done is that the farmer grew the cotton and then took it to the gin. The gin took the seed out of the cotton and made it into what's called a flat bale, which weighs 500 pounds. They're 500 pounds or within plus or minus 20 pounds. Then that went to a warehouse, which also had a compress. And they were stored in the warehouse until they got a shipping order. That might be in 2 weeks. That might be in 9 months. Once you get the shipping order, they take the bale and they compress it into half of the normal size. The height and the width stay the same, but the other dimension, the depth of it, changes by half, from 48 inches to 24 inches. When you put cotton on a railroad car, which is the way that 90% of all cotton was done for 80, 90 years, you can never surpass the weight restriction of the car, but you do run out of capacity, volume. So by compressing the bale, which takes 1 million pounds of pressure square inch and a huge cotton press, steam powered, you can put 150 bales on a railroad car. So our family was never in the ownership of cotton business because the compress rarely owned any cotton that was owned by the farmer, but we warehoused it for the farmer or for the government if it went into the loan. And then we compressed it and sampled it to send us one sample to the state and one sample to the farmer. And then that's how you sold the cotton, is off your sample, because cotton is an identity preserve commodity. Whereas soybeans, corn, and wheat, you deliver a number two. So if you have a number one, you blend it with number three to get number two and vice versa. But everything's number two. And when it goes in that elevator, you don't know which is yours and which is your neighbor's. Okay. In cotton, every bale has a grade and staple and micronair. And therefore, every bale has a six-digit number. In the old days, now it's much more complicated on it. And that you buy each individual bale because of the grade and staple, grade being the color, staple being the length of the fiber, micronair being the strength of the fiber. So it's an identity preserve. So that's very important that each bale be handled specifically and is sold and can be a shipper slash buyer may buy 500 bales out of a warehouse, and it may be from 30 different farmers. He may be buying 5 from this guy, 10 from this guy, because he's evaluating each bale on its grade, staple, and micronaire. So anyway, we were in that business for 100 years, and I went down to the New Orleans Commodity Exchange in 1981 when they restarted trading cotton and started trading cotton. My grandfather had been a cotton trader on the New Orleans Cotton Exchange till they closed it down in 1962.
So there's a lot of history there for you. I think you told me the other day when we talked, you called it aristocratic. What did you mean by that?
I said it's aristocratic fraternity. The people in the cotton business are an aristocratic fraternity. It is a small commodity compared to corn, wheat, beans, and stuff like that. It's more like rice. It's a small deal that's only in a few states. Texas is number one in the nation in cotton production. Mississippi used to be number two, but now Georgia's number two. You used to have short staple cotton in Texas and then longer staple cotton in out of the Mississippi Delta and the better lands. And you make shirts and nice clothes, linens out of long staple cotton, and short staple cotton is made for T-shirts and underwear and blue jeans. So now with the new technology at Texas Tech and Texas A&M, we are growing longer staple cotton in West Texas. And you can get as good a staple cotton out of West Texas as you can out of Mississippi Delta or Georgia. And the reason it was short staple before is you could not make a strong cotton plant that could withstand the bad, horrible weather and windstorms in West Texas and have long staple. But now through technology and genetics, we now make a longer staple cotton that can has a plant that withstand the high winds and the brutal weather of West Texas.
You're in your office there in Waco. You follow the market extremely closely each and every day. Give folks a sense who may not follow it on as close a basis as you. What happened in 2020? It was one of those commodities that had a very deliberate step higher. Why?
Well, there are two or three people that are the big buyers of cotton, U.S. cotton and cotton in general. And that is China, one of the biggest producers in the world, but also a big consumer. I just like soybeans, one of the biggest producers in rice, but also one of the biggest consumers in the world, importers. And then you have Turkey, which has some good mills where we sell a lot of cotton. And then you have Pakistan that does some, but they also produce a lot of cotton. So cotton is, we're back to the aristocrat fraternity idea. It's a very small crop. Everybody knows each other. If you're in any of the associations, you know everybody else in the other associations, the Houston Generals Association, the Warehouseman Association, the Growers Association, and everybody knows everybody, okay? It's a crop that you plant because you always planted or because you love it. It is hard to plant, hard to maintain, hard to grow. It's easily to be disappointed by the weather. And when you only have limited export customers like China and Turkey, it's easy to be frustrated on the export side by bribes from other countries that are producers in, say, South America or wherever else. But people that grow cotton are going to grow cotton because they're not going to switch out every year. They grow it now. They've got to make a decision to buy a $300,000 picker. And that picker can't be used for corn, wheat, or beans, or rice. It's got to be used for cotton. So you're making an investment that you're going to plant cotton year in and year out, whereas my corn, wheat, and bean customers, from one year to another, they may plant no corn, all beans. They may plant no wheat, all corn and beans. They may plant all corn and wheat, no beans. They can switch back around and rotate. And, of course, cotton steals the nitrogen out of the soil. So you've got to rotate your cotton land. But if you're planting cotton and you made the investment in the equipment, you're probably going to plant cotton every year. Because of that, you don't lose as many acres unless the price really goes below cost of production. And even then, you'll still have people grow cotton.
Well, so right now,
price rise,
go ahead.
The price rise is because of the demand is coming back because China has stayed on the sidelines for a long time. Turkey stayed on the sidelines. And now they are back in the market slowly buying, and we've had some weather problems. And so because of the weather problems, we are seeing supply limited.
So do you see 21's acreage battle not as big of a story? If you've got fringe acres, if you're one of those producers that can produce multiple things, will you in 21, or are you still going to be all cotton? And do you expect cotton acres to defend themselves?
No, I don't think there are many people at all that are all cotton, because the fact that it takes much nitrogen out, you need to rotate. So I do not think you will see many people all cotton, unless it's some giant, huge industrial farm. I think everybody will rotate. That makes sense. We've known that for decades now. I mean, really 8 decades since the Great Depression. So there will be some shift, but where a guy's planting 2,000 to 3,000 acres, he's going to have corn and wheat on some of it, and he's going to have 500 acres of cotton. And he'll rotate that 500 acres of cotton. But you are in an acreage battle every year, and cotton will rise. When they see soybeans and corn rise like this, they know we will lose some acres in the South. And as a result, you're going to have to go up to keep those acres, because you can shave from 500 acres down to 400 acres. You know, one of the interesting things a lot of people don't know about cotton production in America is the biggest increase in cotton production is in Kansas. Now, Missouri bluegill has always been a big growing cotton area over the last 25 years, but Kansas has got a tremendous amount of cotton production that we never used to see. It used to be Texas and Mississippi, and of course, Arizona for the Pima, and now Georgia's taken over as number two behind Texas in cotton production.
So that's an interesting part of Kansas, because are they switching? Is wheat the biggest loser then when it comes to acres in Kansas, or is it the corn and soybeans?
I think it has to be a little corn and a little wheat, both.
Okay.
I don't think you're going to plant cotton on soybean land. It's just too big of a draw there. And now with bean acres, you're just not going to do that. But you could do it on some corn land that you want to rotate, and you can do it on some wheat land. Wheat is a weed. It will grow with very little rain. Cotton is very similar. It doesn't need a lot of rain. It just needs it at certain times, whereas corn and beans need a lot of rain.
Was there any concern about cotton, say, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, when after a good run-up in price, there was a drop? Was there any concern for the U.S. cotton industry in the long term then? Have we come out of any doubts about this industry?
No, we have not at all. As a matter of fact, the cotton industry has been on decline in this country for 25 years because of the dominance of China and the fact that we're really sort of the major importer is one large person that many times can't be trusted. I've had a lot of friends. I've had a lot of friends that have stopped brokering cotton because they would try to sell cotton to China. China would say, well, we can't make a final deal. We'll buy it from you. We can't make a final deal till we get it here in our duty-free warehouse. You get it to a duty-free warehouse, and then they say, well, it's not the quality that we really want, no matter what the grade and staple on the green card from the government says, and therefore you've got to discount it so much that now there's no profit in it, and your alternative is to ship it back to America, and that's too expensive. And so it's really a problem. Cotton has been on decline. But again, aristocrat fraternity, and there are people that are going to plant cotton. But it's just not something that new people are getting into if they're trying to maximize profit. A young man trying to maximize profit right away, he's going to plant corn and beans if he can. Now, in Texas, you can't plant beans. You can plant corn and wheat. But there will always be some cotton acreage.
You mentioned corn in Texas, and you're just a couple of weeks away from some starting to plant corn. Do you think more folks are going to plant corn or soybeans just on those two crops, given what the market has done here in the last few weeks?
Texas represents about 10% of the nation's corn production, as opposed to the I states where you are that are 50, 60%. We about 10%, Oklahoma about 10%. Corn, of course, prices are profitable now for the first time in many years because we had the tariffs. But oh yes, corn production will be up, but cotton production probably will be up some too. Wheat will probably be the loser in the corn wheat battle there. and maybe a little bit of cotton, wheat acre go to cotton. But yes, corn will be here. We don't have the option soybeans in Central Texas. There's some soybeans grown up in the Red River Valley near Texarkana, and there's some grown in the Texas coast, but that's not an option. It's not wet enough here. We average about 32 inches of rain a year, and you can't do well with beans with that kind of moisture. So corn acres will be up. It used to be when I was growing up, and I'm in my mid-60s, that everything was Milo around here because we had a big chicken industry, and that they wanted Milo. And then we had the sugarcane aphid cane and kind of destroyed the Milo, but we also had a major premium for corn. And so people plant corn if they think they can get away with it, and we do plant the last week of February. We plant corn the last week of February. We plant Milo the second week of March. So if you get to the second week of March and haven't gotten planted, a lot of people may go to Milo, but then you have to spray for the sugarcane aphid. And by the time you've sprayed twice, your profit's gone. So, yes, we'll be planting here in about 5 weeks.
All right, Markham, final thing here. As you look to 2021 immediately, what do you see as an outlook for price for those producers and just overall health and state of the cotton industry?
Well, the cotton industry in Central Texas is seeing a resurgence. The majority of the cotton business has moved to the Lubbock High Plains area, and still there's a lot of cotton in the San Angelo Southern Plains area. There was a lot of cotton in Harlingen for many, many years. That's the first cotton in the nation to come off and be harvested, but you have hurricanes down there in August, and so many times people have had a beautiful cotton crop only to have it devastated by a hurricane. So you're very vulnerable down there. So I would say that Harlingen, where it used to be 20 to 25% of the Texas cotton crop, it's now probably 10 or 15. And the vast majority is in the high plains around Lubbock and the southern plains around San Angelo and that area between San Angelo and Lubbock. Central Texas was the cotton, i.e. Waco, was the cotton capital of the world in 1920. And we have the Brazos River here that was navigable all the way to the coast, down to Houston. We had fertile land. The Brazos River bottom is very much like the Mississippi Delta, wonderful black land, good, perfect for cotton. But cotton really went down here for about 20 years. And about 10 years ago, it started coming back as a crop rotation, and weather started being more amenable to growing cotton. But the gins that I do business with have seen a big resurgence. And in Central Texas, it is coming back as a crop. In Lubbock, and there, it's always been a big crop. It's about 75% of the Texas cotton crop. They go up and down with price because there's not much else you can do with that land unless you put it under center pivot. There's corn grown out there in your center pivot. There's wheat grown. But as far as dry land, and there's a lot of the cotton is irrigated too, but some of it, a lot of it's dry land too, and you just can't do much corn or wheat under dry land conditions.
Markham, you opened up an entire can of worms about water, which is a whole nother discussion we'll have to have another time. Thank you so much for your time, Markham. I appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you very much. Nice to see you.
All right, Rogers, one of the things I always like to ask people is a little bit of a background. Birthday is kind of a historic thing there. Let's just start with, it was your birthday this week.
Yeah, just yesterday. And I think Robert E. Lee was also born on that day. So people always sang me Dixie instead of happy birthday. And I've made it to 68 years old. And I think I'm as old as your friend Markham.
Well, yeah, you two are quite the characters. You live up to, you guys kind of know each other a little bit, and there's some history there. It's kind of like the background of cotton from what I'm understanding, but what is your background?
Well, I went to Ole Miss, got a degree in engineering, and went to work overseas, came back to New Orleans, and I was working in the engineering world, and I got a master's in engineering and business at Tulane. And at the time, my father was a merchant in the cotton industry, and my two brothers had just gotten into business, and it looked like they were having more fun than I was. And so I used the business degree from Tulane and some of my first 2 years in engineering to help me make the transition. But I came to work with them, and we've had a really good, prosperous, 35, 38 years, and been a lot of fun working with your family. And so that's how I got into this crazy business.
Working with your family, you know, some people, when they say working with their family, they say they could never do it. And then others will say, I can't imagine not doing it. So you sound like you're in the B category.
That's right. And we have had arguments and quarrels and whatever, but I think we understood that, okay, you know, let's make this work. Nobody falls out. Somebody's always going to be having a different opinion. But as long as you get in there and work hard and, you know, try to make things right, I think it can work.
How would you describe the state of agriculture in Mississippi? I mean, we know as a Delta state that there are certain traditions, just like you always think about an I state, just being corn and soybeans. There's more to it than that. But with you being such a difference of north to south and just how much different those climates can be, what's the crop makeup?
Well, we're in the Delta, and that would be the northwest part of the state. And for sure, it's probably the most, the best soil in the country. And some people say it may be the best in the world. Just depends on maybe the Nile River Delta or a couple of other places. But for sure, we are blessed with good soils. And so that's where the majority of the agriculture is in Mississippi. It's in the northwest part. And as far as the state of agriculture, this year it's turned out to be magnificent because of the increase in prices. And so we're going into next year with a lot of optimism and hope. And I think there's going to be some good rewards at the end of the year.
From an outside perspective, when you stare at the 2020 mark, the chart, the mark of it has been on a steady increase. Why was it steady and not as volatile as maybe it's been in the past or other commodities have been? What was the underlying current that kind of kept that on a steady march higher?
Well, I think the main thing is that during this entire rally, not only in cotton but in the other ag markets, the dollar has gone down, and we've had a lot of speculative fund money that have come into the markets. At the same time, we've had better demand. There's a lot of anticipation of demand for commodities being better once the corona or the COVID situation is over. And we've had some bites from Mother Nature to cut into the crop. We seem to be in West Texas about every other year. We're in a drought, and West Texas has been in drought, and they're still in drought. And then, as you recall, last summer, it seemed to be from mid-July all the way into mid-October, the rest of the cotton-producing states were hit with one hurricane or one tropical storm after another. And while none of them took huge chunks off the market production, they did whittle away. And so from last, what I thought was a 20 million bale crop back in May, Mother Nature has cut 5 million bales off of that. And that is a huge amount. That's a fourth of the production to cut off of our potential.
So you have a reduction in the crop, and that's what happened in corn and soybeans, you know, big commodity crops. China, you mentioned, a little bit, or maybe I didn't hear China there. What was the global demand, or is it a domestic demand that pulls on this crop?
It's both, and there's a couple of ideas or theories about China. And one, it's hard to put your finger on, but over the last year or so, maybe due to political reasoning, China has been backing away from buying as many U.S. treasuries as before. And so the theory is that there's so much money that goes into treasuries that if they stop buying as much, then just a little bit of that money, if it sloshes over into our markets, it drives our markets crazy. And we saw during 2010, 2011, a few years after, that China can easily buy and store commodities on a whim or on a government mandate. And cotton is a lot more easily stored than some of the grain markets. It does not deteriorate as fast. And so there's that theory that China is buying more cotton because they're not buying as many treasuries. Plus, they've got to satisfy the first part of the what they call the phase one trade deal. They're behind. And then China has gotten into a rift with Australia. And Australia had said some things publicly about China's making military installations in the South Sea, mistreating their Uyghurs. And so China hits back at that, and they banned imports of Australian cotton and a couple of other commodities. I think one is beef. I forget what the other one is. But at the moment, we're seeing robust demand from China due to two or three different reasons.
As you go into 21, do you see the industry having more headwinds or tailwinds? Or is it going to be choppy seas? Let's use a sailing metaphor.
Well, I look at the balance sheet first. I'm a balance sheet guy, and you know, you like to try to calculate the production based on the yield, the acres. Then you take a look at the consumption and what we're going to do. I look at the cotton balance sheet, and it's gone from being extremely burdensome back in May to being what I would call adequate today. We're not in a shortage, but we're nowhere near we were back in May. And I think the price on the new crop at 77, 78 cents, it would be considered an inducement to plant if it was not for one other thing, and that would be the prices of the other row crops. And once you get out of West Texas, and let's just start at the Louisiana border with Texas, that would be the Sabine River. Basically, all the states east of the Sabine River plant cotton and have alternatives. But the areas of West Texas, Kansas, Oklahoma, Arizona, California, they don't. They either plant cotton or they don't know what to do. So anyway, we've got a good price going in. And we got two variances or variables out there. One is the drought in West Texas, and West Texas has the highest density of acreage in this country for sure. And nobody really knows if we're going to get enough rain to plant those Texas crops. If we do, and we get a couple of three rains during the year, okay, we'll have a lot more cotton. If we don't, well, then the price has to take care of it. But the other thing is the price of soybeans right now is leading what I call the profitability tables. And generally what I do is I take the states that grow cotton. I think there's 15, and there's six major row crops, cotton, rice, wheat, corn, sorghum. Okay, what did I leave out? Soybeans. And soybeans have the most profitable potential of all. And then right after that, it's sort of a tie between corn, sorghum, cotton, and wheat. and the worst crop, but it's not a losing crop. It just doesn't make as much money as the others, is rice. So I always watch the acres, watch the battle for acres, which is going on right now. The farmers are making decisions what to plant basically from mid-December up until, oh, maybe late January. And then by that time, they've pretty much contracted for 80, 90, maybe 100% of what they're going to do. And so the price that is being listed on the board today is very important.
The price is always, it seems to be, it's always talked about, whether we're high or low or up or down or what the trend is. But given what we've seen since October, November, December into January on this dramatic run, specifically corn and soybeans, and you kind of talk about some of those producers in your area, Rod, what are they thinking right now? Because it's one thing in July or June to be thinking what you're going to do the next year. But with this sudden change so late in the game, do you have producers really on the fence still? Or do you think they already kind of know? You hinted that some might be making a change, but when do they make that decision? And can they make it super late in the game, say a week or two before it's time to plant?
They can, but that would be on a, what I would call a marginal amount of acreage. I think that you take a farmer with 1,000 acres, he's probably already got an idea on 900 of them right now what he's going to do. And, you know, maybe later, depending upon seed availability and late price, he could make do with the last 40 or 100 acres. But going into the late January, I think 90% of the decisions are already made, because the seed companies require a pretty good bit of advance notice, just so they know what to prepare for and they know how many seeds to make available to the market.
And that availability of seed is a game that plays out. So if you've got, let's just say 50 clients, let's just use that as a nice round number. What percentage of them are contemplating changing 20% or more of their acres to, say, from cotton to corn or soybeans, or maybe a different crop?
Well, that's a really good calculation or study to do, and it's what I've been doing since before Thanksgiving. My guess, and I'll use general terms, and then I'll get specific. Soybean acreage will be maximized. Then it gets to be a real scramble between corn, cotton, and the other crops, which are what I would consider more marginal acres. We don't see much wheat and sorghum anymore. I think rice acreage will be minimized. And then you get into the difficulty and the cost of the crops. So soybeans is by far the most preferable because it is the least costly and the least risk. And then you move into cotton, which is the most costly. And right behind that is rice and corn. So I've already got a pretty good idea and a pretty good sense of history for what goes in the ground this year. And you want to base it on what will cotton lose to these other markets. My guess is cotton to corn will be insignificant. I don't think, unless there's some sort of rotation that the farmer, the Pacific farmer is looking at, I don't think there's going to be much loss. I think the real loss is going to be cotton to soybeans. And what I'm picking up is 20% in some of these Mid-South situations. Two or three guys I know are going to zero out their cotton. These are guys that don't own a picker, and they don't have the commitment of having to finance a $750,000 picker. The guys with pickers are going to plant cotton. They're just not going to plant as much. So I'm looking at a 12 to 20% reduction in acres. And I'd like to mention one other thing. Where I start my calculations is from the March intentions report. That would be March of 2020. And the reason I'm doing that is because a lot of the Texas acreage was counted as never being planted. And so when you look at the total U.S. plantings for the last year, you're getting a distorted view because the intentions last March were 13.7 million, but all we planted was 12.1. So there was about a 1.6, 1.7 million category they call prevent. And I think if people start their acreage calculations on what we actually put in the ground, that's going to be a little bit too low for reality. So I think the better starting point is to go back to the March intentions and then start cutting cotton acres from there.
Well, and that's a common thing we've heard as well. A lot of these prevent plant acres, whether it was too wet in the Dakotas or Iowa or Nebraska, Minnesota, once those come back in, that's going to bump up both corn and soybeans. So, Rogers, as you look to 21, if I'm a cotton producer, I'm on the fence, I decide to stick with cotton because I see the neighbor going to something else, do I win in the sense there's going to be less cotton acres, therefore my product becomes more valuable? Is there a thinking like that among producers too? Take out the whole equipment discussion that we were just having.
Yes, you could be very right, and we've looked at that. We have tried to ascertain what the balance sheet would have to go to in order to drive the price higher. And the acreage part of it in the states east of the Sabine River, they are important. But the real, real big important factor is what happens in West Texas, and do all those prevent acres get a rain or two or three? Do they come back? And that's going to be the roulette wheel in trying to grow cotton, because now so much of our production is concentrated in that area, which is quite small compared to everything else.
All right. I appreciate the insight, Rogers. Thank you so much. Good to hear that the same discussions that happen for corn and soybean acres are the same ones that happen in cotton, sorghum, and rice in other parts of the country. Good to hear from you, Rogers Varner. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
If you have any feedback for us, hit us up at markettomarket@iowapbs.org. My thanks to both Markham Dossett and Rogers Varner for their time. Thank you for watching. We'll see you next time.